we say loving drug users, that does not mean loving drug users in spite of the fact that they use drugs or even though they use. It's loving drug users as drug users and not trying to make condition or create contingencies when we're talking about our love and our care and compassion for people that use drugs.
Bright Spark is a podcast about harm reduction. In this podcast, we feature people doing the bold, innovative, and necessary work that is saving lives and fighting against the stigmatization of drug users and drug use.
This is Bright Spark number 3, Opening the Psychic Space. In this episode, we feature Sam Young, a harm reduction worker and organizer and a self-described inactive drug user.
This monologue is adapted from a presentation that Sam gave to a group of radical nurses in the spring of 2018. And it's important to note that the intended audience for this talk was originally aimed at service providers.
I've had the pleasure of working alongside Sam for the last 2 years at the Portland People's Outreach Project, a harm reduction site here in Portland. Sam has a relentless energy and generosity that makes him one of the many volunteers that keeps PPOP going strong week after week. Sam is open-handed with knowledge, skills, resources, cigarettes, bad jokes, and positive vibes. We are really happy to give him some space to share some thoughts here.
I volunteer with a group called the Portland People's Outreach Project, PPOP. It's an all-volunteer organization here in Portland that serves drug users. We are usually classified as a needle exchange, but we don't do exchange because we operate on a need-based model, meaning when we provide syringes to drug users, we do not require that they return and dispose of used needles in order to acquire new ones, and we don't make how many needles somebody gets contingent on how many old ones they dispose of. I think that model, need-based model, is not only the appropriate and right way of practicing this needle exchange from a moral and ethical level, but it is the right thing as backed up by countless studies and science and any way you want to look at it from an evidence perspective, in the sense that when you don't require that people return used needles, you're going to make it more possible for people to be able to avoid sharing needles or reusing needles, which, as we know, can lead to transmission of hepatitis C and HIV. And I think perhaps underemphasized is the reuse of one's own needle, which is extremely common here in Portland because of the lack of syringes, contributes a lot to all sorts of other ailments, abscesses, cellulitis, endocarditis. There's the whole litany of health issues that injection drug users have to face. So we provide new needles. We provide other injection supplies. We provide Narcan or Naloxone. We provide meth pipes. We provide wound care supplies, safer sex supplies, and then basic services, emergency services, because a lot of the folks we're seeing are houseless. So we're meeting the harm reduction needs, but we're also trying to meet their needs, whether it be tampons and pads or sleeping bags or tents or clothes or coffee, whatever we can try and do. I've been volunteering with PPOP for more than 3 years. I want to emphasize, though, that there's 30 or 40 other amazing volunteers. So when I talk and mention things related to PPOP, I also want to clarify that I'm not necessarily speaking on behalf of the organization. I'm speaking from my own personal experience with the organization. I have been with the organization since it began. PPOP was started by a local person, actually my housemate, Aaron Johnson. He was a volunteer with the People's Harm Reduction Alliance, or PRA, which PPOP, our organization, is actually a member of. We are the Portland chapter of PRA. He was moving to Portland, and part of the impetus was, if I can speak for him, to create a need-based syringe access program here. There weren't, and there still aren't, any other services that are really need-based, meaning all the other syringe access in Portland is one for one. Because of that, there was and continues to be a real deficit in access to syringes, access to harm reduction supplies, and consequentially, really high rates of hepatitis C, really high rates of abscesses and infections that are caused in different ways by lack of access to necessary harm reduction supplies. Drug users are not getting what they need here. PRA, as the nonprofit that we're a part of, they have been an incredible trailblazer in harm reduction. They've done an enormous amount for drug users over the years. For several years, they were, by volume, the largest syringe exchange in the country. The spirit that they really embody is loving drug users. We strive to have our volunteers be active users. This is not an abstracted need or issue. for many of the volunteers in the organization are either active or previous drug users. For any of the volunteers that don't identify as active or previous drug users, they have a lot of personal interaction with drug users. They have a lot of history around drug users, whether it's family members, whether it's people they work with. So we're not just about saying, oh, addiction is a disease and we're going to do our best to kind of reduce the harms. I think we're more about approaching this issue, not from what our needs are to, you know, reduce the impact that drug use has on the rest of society, but we start off from how can we address what drug users identify as what's important to them and what's affecting them. I also want to touch on my own personal history of drug use. I think it's really important to emphasize my past drug use. Obviously, there's an element of privilege that allows certain people to talk about their present or past drug use and certain people to not be able to do that. But for whomever is able to do that, I think it's really important that they push the boundaries. So I am fortunate enough to be in this position to be able to talk about my past drug use, in part because that's my past drug use and not my present drug use. I'm not currently using any drugs, and so I identify as an inactive drug user. I definitely don't identify as being in recovery or being abstinent. I have been a daily heroin and cocaine injector in the past. I've been a daily crack smoker and other periods occasional meth injector. For the last 7 years or so, I've been on methadone, and that really works for me. There's still stigma around it, but it's very vital to acknowledge that I am taking a drug daily that is licit and that is available to me much more accessibly than illicit drugs. In other ways, you know, I do have some things to risk. Should I decide that I want to use, whether it be meth or, you know, benzodiazepines or cocaine or heroin or whatever, I risk losing my takeouts at my clinic. Methadone regulations are definitely an issue for people, and because of those strict regulations, I have very specific rules I have to abide by. I also think it's necessary to explicitly mention that I also have the privilege of being white and straight and cisgender, of not having a criminal background. I was very lucky because there's a lot of times in my life where I very easily could have gotten caught up with legal charges or that in some other way my life have gone worse because of interaction with the criminal justice system. So I'm very fortunate there. I was also fortunate enough to be able to have cleared the hepatitis C virus from my body, which is the case for about 20% of people. 20% of people are exposed. So in yet another way, I don't suffer from the long-lasting consequences of lack of access to syringes. I've been lucky enough to be pretty well informed on those safer drug use practices, pretty well informed on what are the things that I need to do to keep myself safe and alive and functioning. That's not me having some amazing resilience or inner strength. That is a function of the privilege I have, being able to have family connections, being able to have relatively middle-class background, people around me that provided support when I was struggling. And so the people that maybe didn't have that, the people, some of whom we serve who are houseless, who cut off from a lot of meaningful positive support, I don't think that that's a function of them not being resilient or not having that inner strength. I think it's a function of what limitations people's lives expose them to and lack of access to privilege. So much of what we associate with drugs and drug users is so tied up with drug prohibition by the fact that much of what we think of as being the effects of drugs themselves or what happens when people use drugs are actually the direct or indirect consequences of drugs being illegal. One prominent example is the fact that for many daily drug users, their lives are centered around acquiring money to pay for their drug. The black market, when drugs are illegal, creates a profit incentive, and this artificially raises drug prices to the point that they're not affordable. There's absolutely no reason drugs should be expensive other than that black market. So drug users are forced to fund their drug use a variety of ways. Some have jobs, some have inheritance or money that they've come into or from family. But a lot of people are forced to engage in low-level drug dealing, in sex work, and then especially in property crime. And I want to emphasize that when people engage in those illegal activities to acquire money for drugs, that's not based on an underlying moral failing. That's based on people needing to provide for their psychic and emotional well-being. It's very easy to judge people who may steal, but if we were to put ourselves in their shoes and see that they're trying to provide for their basic emotional health in the only way they can because they are pushed into a corner. When we make drugs illegal, the price goes up. I think you can see in many examples around the world that when a drug that people use is not prohibited, when it is legal, there is not that price elevation. And so a nice example I like to give is that there's not too many people that are committing daily property crime to access money for alcohol. There's not a lot of people boosting stuff from stores or engaging in sex work or any of the other things drug users are forced to do to pay for their caffeine consumption. And whatever type of drug it is, people have needs. They have emotional and psychic needs. And it's not for anybody else to judge what role that substance plays in their lives. I think we need to move away from this hedonist and judgmental notion that drug users are selfish. And to facilitate that selfishness, they're willing to be abusive and to steal and to rob and do whatever they can without any care to other people. And I think you'll find that the large majority of people that are doing things that we may judge as unethical to acquire drugs are not wanting to do those things. And in large majority of the cases do have an enormous moral self-questioning when it comes to that. And it's not been an easy path for them. And I think they'll be the first people to tell you that. There's plenty of drug users that don't commit any other crimes than possession, but even for the ones that who are committing crimes related to their drug use, it's so vital that we don't ignore the fact that those people in large part are not going to be engaging in that activity if not for drugs being expensive. Because the impact of drug prohibition is so pervasive, I think we have a real problem recognizing how much drug users are stigmatized even when we're presenting services in their interests. So one example of harm reduction, the words themselves I think are really problematic. They inherently stigmatize drug use because they say that using drugs is inherently harmful and that our job in public health or in social services or healthcare is to mitigate that harm, with the unspoken assumption being that drug use is bad and wrong and harmful to one's health. But since it's happening anyways, we might as well make it less poisonous to users and the people around them. This is kind of analogous to how we talk about homelessness in Portland, for example, where the issue in the public discourse isn't the fact that there's thousands of other human beings that are sleeping outside and that don't have a place to live. It's that homelessness is the visual blight in our neighborhood we don't like, or that homeless people are leaving needles near our homes, or homeless people are committing crimes around our homes. And so the fact that there's human beings around us that don't have a place to live, that's not the moral failing of our society. The failing is attributed to the individual homeless people because of the way they impact our comfortable lives. So there's all the stories in the local media, for example, about the scourge of needles. I think this is an easy way to scapegoat homeless people by ascribing an entire potential social ill to drug use itself. It's fascinating to me because this topic gets mentioned and addressed over and over and over again. This whole issue is so incredibly distorted from the real needs that drug users don't have enough needles and then that they're being arrested for carrying them. I think that you'll see a lot of the needles on the ground disappear if drug users are given really accessible ways to dispose of them. And if they are told, and if there's a practice carried out where drug users know that they cannot be arrested for use syringes, which is very much something people are arrested for in Portland. We need to really ask ourselves, how do we transform the way we approach this issue? How do we treat drug users better? How do we escape this dominant paradigm of drug prohibition being the underlying factor in how we understand all of drug use? How do we start thinking about what are the needs of drug users and what is happening to drug users because of prohibition? And how is that drug prohibition affecting the lives of drug users in terms of the choices that they're given and the support that they're exposed to? The principles that PPOP and PRA operate on can really provide a really powerful model for a bigger paradigm of working with drug users and approaching drug use in our society. I think, first of all, harm reduction and the way we engage drug users has to be founded on meeting them where they're at. And so what I mean by that is both physically, so meeting people directly where they are. So, for example, PPOP goes directly to people's camps and where they congregate. We don't just say, oh, do you need needles? Do you need Narcan? Do you need wound care supplies? Do you need support and love? Well, come to us. And if you really want it, you'll do the work to take the bus or drive or get to us and make sure that you can plan around your day to get there. And when you are trying to make sure you have enough drugs to keep you sane and keep you going every day, it makes it really challenging to be able to plan around getting to a syringe exchange that's open for a couple hours a day in one particular area. So we really work to go directly to where people are. This is something that harm reduction absolutely has to practice, and not just with physically, meeting people physically where they're at, but meeting people where they're at in their drug use. And so if somebody is injecting drugs, we need to meet those needs and listen to what do you need for your injection drug use to be safe and healthy. The underlying implication of a lot of the philosophy of mainstream harm reduction is we're the experts. We provide the tools. You come and get them. If you want to be safe and healthy, the onus has to be on you. We need to take the onus off people. In order to do this, we have to first step off of our high horse of judging what people are doing as being immoral or unethical, and get back to the notion that what somebody puts in their body is a personal choice. To start with, we need to acknowledge that we can't tell people that what they're doing with their own body is wrong. This is a bigger perspective that public health needs to embody. If you want people to be healthy and safe and happy, you need to make the tools to be safe and healthy and happy as accessible as possible. That can sometimes mean physically going direct to the people, but it should generally mean removing as many of the barriers that users face in their daily lives, making it as easy as possible for people not just to get the physical tools, but to get the education. And then especially to get the compassion and love. We can't assume that everyone has the social capital and cultural capital and the education to be able to know what good, for example, injection practices are, to know where services are, to know what service they need, to be able to feel comfortable talking to healthcare social service providers. It's especially true in light of the fact that drug users are among the most traumatized and mistreated people in our society. Whether it be from businesses, whether it be from police, whether it be from any of the institutions, even healthcare and social service institutions are immensely traumatized and immensely mistreated. When they go to the emergency room, they are treated like dirt. They are all but told that the nurses and providers and staff of the ED think that they're drug-seeking, think that they're criminals. That's not even to speak of the many cases of people going to the ED multiple times for real issue they were having in their body and being turned away multiple times, and then going again or being picked up in the ambulance and finding out that it's some severe life-threatening issues. It's inescapable that drug users are faced with daily trauma. We need to make sure that we're trauma-informed, but we need to make sure those things are accessible, because drug users have so many reasons not to access services and to have to survive and struggle with avoiding any engagement with those services because of how poorly they've been treated. When you're serving this population, there's a few things that you always have to be doing in order to meet people where they're at. I think the first thing is you have to meet their basic material needs. In that sense, I think our organization is worthless if we're not there every Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, which is the days PPOP provides services, providing needles and injection supplies and meth pipes and naloxone. That's a basic intervention in people's lives, and it's really important in my mind that meeting those needs is not premised on reciprocity or the recipient having to bring anything to the table. I really believe in the ethic of the gift and providing services and material things to other people in our community, because we believe in mutual aid and the power of compassion. And that honestly, when people are trying to survive, a lot of times those more concrete material needs are the most important thing to them. I can think of church groups that will tell houseless folks or drug users that they're loved and that they're all God's children, but it's like, hey, if I don't have dinner on the table, if I don't have the needle I need to fix tonight, all that love is kind of irrelevant. We're going to meet people where they're at and not talk down to them. We're going to have to provide them what they say they need and do it without this expectation of reciprocity, which in the case of syringe exchange is part of the problem of making a syringe exchange one for one. You have to give us something to get these needles. A lot of the way we approach this issue is telling people that you can't just get things for free. If you want something, if you want a social service, you're going to have to work for it. That's not only the wrong approach from an ethical standpoint, it's wrong from a practical and long-term social service philosophy standpoint, which is if you provide the services, if you make things available to people and do it because they're needed, that eventually creates a reinforcing dynamic where people are going to invest back in their communities, and then that's going to really lead to an improvement in indices of health and well-being, and then you're going to have people that are helping each other and there's fewer sick people. all the evidence that exists in public health indicates this is the best way to engage, and especially with syringes, as I mentioned. Every piece of evidence that I know of says that you don't require people to return used syringes in order to get new ones. To me, that's as basic as saying that you should provide condoms to people without requiring that they return used condoms if you want to reduce STI. It's important to say syringe exchanges that are one-for-one are somewhat of a different position, PPOP, because they have to potentially face political fallout that can result in them changing their approach to services. They're facing potential political consequences. I think it becomes a real sticky issue because while I acknowledge that programs constantly have to be fighting for their funding and they constantly have to worry about the way funders or the way the public is going to react should they take what is perceived as radical stances, I also think everyone needs to perpetually strive to be both strategic in that sense, but also aggressive, and not allow these issues and the way we approach these issues to become self-fulfilling prophecies where our fears dictate what's possible. For example, PPOP decided to provide meth pipes. Now, for a lot of people, that's challenging. That's scary. And with meth pipes, there's absolutely not one shred of evidence saying that if you provide people meth pipes, more drug use will happen or more harmful drug use will happen. It's kind of a measure of how inverted and upside down our society's discourse and approach to these issues are too often based on hysteria that has no basis in reality. The stuff that does exist, safe injection sites, naloxone distributions, even heroin maintenance, those things all have the evidence behind them. Unfortunately, we can't just point to that and win. We constantly have to justify our own existence. The opposition says, well, show us how these things don't cause harm. There is evidence, in fact, that a lot of these things don't increase drug use, but there's no evidence that we could disprove that says that they increase drug use. So we're being asked to disprove a negative. We have to remember that it's an uphill battle and that sometimes, no matter how much evidence we present, the opposition, the drug warriors, the Donald Trumps of the world are able to use rhetoric and able to use dogma to battle. And so sometimes we have to use our own rhetoric and dogma. If you make things black and white and you make it about loving drug users and saving lives, it becomes really challenging to disagree with that. You don't want to be the one that says, no, I don't think drug users should have their lives saved. I don't think drug users deserve love. I think that kind of leads me to another aspect of the services that I think PPOP and PRA really try to promote. We want to empower our population as much as possible to not only access the services in an accessible way, we want to empower them to take control of their lives and have a voice in the issue and be listened to. Too often, there's this tendency to speak for them and to say that you're fighting a movement on behalf of this community. We try to have drug users be the ones to talk about their needs as much as possible. We try to have drug users fight this battle and be empowered to have a voice in these issues because, number one, they're going to have a much more accurate and passionate view of what the issues are. That puts them in the position where they can really start to have decisions over how services are run and over how conversations are had. We strive to give drug users the material tools they need to be healthy, but we also think that they're smart enough and strong enough, good enough to be able to decide what those tools are and to decide what constitutes well-being and happiness for them, whether it pertains to where they can access services, techniques for injection or wound care, to what love and compassion means on the street or in these environments. I think our organization really emphasizes over and over, we want drug users to be happy and healthy and safe, but we don't want to constitute that for them. And for a lot of drug users, them being happy means them injecting heroin. If that's what they want to be happy, then we're going to love them and support them in that healthiest, safest, most supportive way possible. And along these lines, as I said, PPOP and PRA strive to peer run. So we try to have active drug users in control of the organization as much as possible. No one knows what's good for drug users better than drug users. I think there's an implicit understanding among many in these fields that while drug users deserve dignity, they can't possibly be on the other side of the table as when it comes to harm reduction or public health, as long as they're using drugs, that they can't be trusted, that they don't have the education or the intelligence or the practical skills to do this. And so much of our perspective of this is shaped by drug prohibition that we kind of assume that if people are doing an illegal drug, they must be out of control, they must not be in full control of their faculties, when in fact there's a lot of drug users daily heroin injectors, weekly heroin injectors, daily crack smokers, occasional crack smokers or meth users that are housed, that have families, that have jobs, and that use on a maintenance level. We don't see that because the conversation is dominated by what prohibition tells us are the effects of drugs, which is it destroys everyone's lives. There is lots of drug use that is unhealthy, but drug use in itself is not unhealthy. If we really examine the unhealthy aspects to drug use, we will see that much of it is constituted by drug prohibition. And I think when you look at cases where drugs have been legalized or drug users have been given access without those challenges, without prohibition getting in the way, you not only see people being happier, but you see them have a lot more time to live their lives like what we would consider normal, to be with their family and raise kids, to have jobs, to have homes, to have stable lives. Drug use is above and beyond everything else a human rights issue. People have the right to put whatever they want in their body. If you look at alcohol, it's a perfect example. Are there people that use alcohol unhealthily? Absolutely. In any population, whether it's drug users, alcohol users, left-handed people, tall people, there are people that are what we consider irresponsible or engage in problematic behavior, but we wouldn't consider left-handed people who steal from other people to be stealing because they're left-handed. It's vital that we don't take drug use out of context of all types of other behaviors and remember that drugs being illegal impacts what drug use looks like a lot more than those other actions that aren't illegal. I also want to speak to a bigger issue in relation to like the way people outside the communities, drug user communities, or in leftist or radical communities approach these issues. Because I've been on and off a member of radical and anarchist communities and different organizations, and I can tell you from personal experience that there's an enormous amount of stigma around hard drug use and drug users among those communities in those spaces. These are people who are normally so adept at analyzing how bigger institutional dynamics and oppressive mechanisms affect how we perceived marginalized populations. To really examine my experience, the stigma I faced was not because of things I did while I was doing drugs. It was faced because it was known that I was using drugs. I think the radical communities are so quick to demonize the drug users, the junkies, and the tweakers in their communities in the same way that non-radical communities and mainstream people do. And it's so preposterous to me that we don't have the insight and the compassion to recognize the way bigger oppressive forces impact the way we conceptualize these communities. Because people who use drugs are forced by prohibition to engage in practices that we view as antisocial or harmful to radical movements, we suddenly stigmatize everyone that uses hard drugs, and we fail to have a trauma-informed perspective. This brings up another really important issue, which I think is the need to not compartmentalize different forms of drug use based on whether that drug use is to self-medicate for physical pain or emotional pain, and whether that drug use is done to experience pleasure or to avoid pain. It's vital that we recognize emotional and physical pain often trigger the same parts of the brain. Why is it that people feel pleasure from using drugs in a way that makes them want to use drugs all day or wants to use drugs often? If you look at any of the more recent neurobiological research, if you look at the study of adverse childhood events, of trauma, of the way the brain reacts physiologically to trauma and the way our body reacts to trauma, you can see that the reason why certain drugs are experienced as pleasurable by certain people has everything to do with their trauma history, everything to do with their emotional history and what has happened in their lives. We're very quick to empathize with people with mental health issues and people with other the effects of trauma beyond just drug use. But for some reason, when it comes to drug use, we're not able to recognize the way trauma goes hand in hand with drug use. And even if it doesn't, even if somebody doesn't have an obvious history of trauma, our answer shouldn't be how do we attack the person engaging in antisocial behavior. It should be how do we make it so antisocial behavior isn't viable to an individual. We don't tell unemployed poor people that the reason why they're poor and unemployed is because they're selfish. We have empathy. We understand the way privilege and power and personal, social, and cultural and economic capital work to implicate people's lives. And suddenly with drug use, we can't do that. The most important thing is to provide love and compassion. It's absolutely essential that when we're serving drug users or any other community, that we're invested in them being happy and healthy, not just in going through the motions of meeting their immediate need right now. the peer-run model is the guide for this, because eventually you have active drug users creating this feedback loop of love and compassion to the point where drug users are feeling empowered by seeing other drug users be the service providers. It's vital that we open up that psychic space. People need the psychic space to heal and be happy, and they can't do that when they're treated like an object, when they're not empowered. A lot of amazing harm reduction folks have explained that syringe exchanges and harm reduction services are just as much about giving drug users a place to be where they're treated with love and where they're given the psychic space to try to heal as they are about the immediate material services. The services can't be neglected. You have to provide them. Maslow's hierarchy of needs. People need food and shelter and clothing, and then they need love and compassion. That's one of the major perspectives, I think, on what a lot of these harm reduction services can be, what a safe injection site can be, what heroin maintenance programs can be, what all types of other healthcare institutions can be. Places where people can go, where it's not just that we give them the tools, the physical tools to try and, inject more safely, but we give them a environment where they can process and they can move forward emotionally and from a trauma and self-medication perspective. With places like safe consumption spaces, that's exactly what is happening, is places where people can go to use drugs and to be able to do something that is a very important part of their life, not only without fear of arrest, but there's people around them that are there for them. It's really unfortunate that with issues like safe consumption spaces, that when they're discussed, they're presented in a way that they're there to mitigate the harm drug users do to their community. So they're not there in a positive kind of empowering way. Unfortunately, I think harm reductions have sometimes made the argument that businesses should be invested in safe consumption spaces because they'll have fewer drug users injecting in their spaces. It should be more than enough of an argument that safe consumption spaces save thousands and thousands of dollars on medical spending, emergency room spending, and more than anything, they save drug users' lives. Something that we circle around and refuse to say is that at some level, the people in our society who are against these harm reduction practices fundamentally don't care about drug users' lives. Moving forward and backwards, I think opening safe consumption spaces is vital, but I think we need to remember we can't let those spaces be so compromised in an effort to open them that their services mistreat drug users. They need to be safe consumption spaces and not safe injection sites. If we don't allow smoking in these safe consumption spaces because of ostensible arguments about smoking health or about ventilation, we're essentially saying we care about injection drug users and not smokers, which is another way of saying we care more about white drug users than black drug users, because proportionally among crack and meth smokers, African Americans constitute more of a presence than among drug injectors, in Portland at least. I think that safe consumption spaces have a lot of power as being small drop-in centers where people can go to, yes, use drugs, but then to access all types of other services and have supportive, compassionate presence around them for at least one part of their day. So we need to remember to model our services in the most ideal way possible. I think with safe consumption spaces and other services, we need to remember that they're also not about healthcare or social service providers, therefore the drug users. They can't be about any particular goals that we have. They can't be about increasing the number of people who access treatment or embrace certain safer injection practices. The goal has to be the drug user's needs, what they identify as their needs, and how to help them face the hurdles they deal with every day. If you consider the amount of trauma and emotional turmoil people who use drugs have had to face, when you start addressing that trauma, you start addressing health. And sometimes you have to start with things that aren't measurable. You have to start with things that build that trust, that allow drug users to enter the door. In general, harm reduction reduces drug uses far more than more mainstream treatment modalities do. When you empower people to make decisions on their own, when you as a provider or social worker or case manager or whatever, let the person you're working with lead the way, you're going to have a lot more success. When you make it more difficult for people to use drugs, you will increase problematic drug use that involves more of a high risk for overdose, for disease transmission, for abscess, for all that stuff. The gold standard of treatment is medication-assisted treatment and a humanistic harm reduction-based supportive atmosphere. Those things, which are very much counter to 12-step and abstinence-based models, are much more successful in terms of the evidence. with PPOP services and more radical harm reduction services, you can see that is an ultimate accomplishment, is we're trying to avoid any foreclosing of possibilities in people's lives. We're trying to open up the psychic space for them to love and be healed and to be happy. If you let people make those decisions on their own, you'll find that they're empowered to make the best decisions for themselves.
This episode is produced by myself, Aaron Yankee, a documentarian and radio producer.
And I am Alec Dunn, a harm reductionist and a nurse, and we produced this episode over the summer of 2018.
Thanks to KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Oregon for technical assistance. The intro music is by Silicon Transmitter. It's the song Aimless Walk and is licensed for use by a Creative Commons non-commercial license and made available from the Free Music Archive.
Outro music is the song Quasi-Stable State by Monopole and is also licensed for use by a Creative Commons non-commercial license and made available from the Free Music Archive.
If you have feedback, comments, or suggestions, feel free to get in touch with us at brightsparkharmreduction@gmail.com.
Thanks for listening.